This message comes from NPR sponsor, Mattress Firm. Sleep hot. Mattress Firm's sleep experts can match you with a cooling mattress from the Tempur-Breeze collection from Tempur-Pedic, so you can experience measurably cooler sleep all night. Get matched at Mattress Firm's Memorial Day sale. Sleep at night.
Hey, y'all. This is Sam's Aunt Betty. This week on the show, host of the podcast, Yo, Is This Racist? Andrew T., and environmental reporter for Calmatics, Julie Clark. All right, let's start the show.
Hey, y'all, from NPR, I'm Sam Sanders. It's been a minute. Happy weekend to my listeners and to my guests. I've got two guests here in studio at NPR West who are coming on the show for the first time ever. Y'all nervous?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Was I supposed to be? I'll be nervous.
Thank you both for being here. Andrew T., host of the podcast, Yo, Is This Racist?
What up?
Also a writer for ABC's Mixed-ish, and Julie Cart, reporter for Cal Matters, covering the environment and the fires. I'm not sure I've ever had two guests whose topics of interest are so different.
I'm not disinterested in the environment. I just don't know anything about it.
Well, I thank you both for being here. We're going to talk about some big topics in the news this week, some heavy stuff. But before we get to that, I do want to take a second to play for you both the audio that made me the happiest this week. It's this cute little song that popped up on the internet about dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs eating people. Dinosaurs in love. Dinosaurs having a party. They eat fruit and cucumber.
Is that not the cutest thing?
Oh, my God.
Don't you love... Is your heart melting yet, Julie?
That child.
Yes, yes.
So eating this... people.
How can you make eating people sound cute? They did it.
It's a vicious young child.
So this audio comes from a Twitter user and musician named Tom Rosenthal. He put this audio up this week. He says the story behind it is that his almost four-year-old daughter, Finn, wrote a song to herself all about dinosaurs. Once he heard it, he was like, I like that. It's got potential. He helped her put music to it. And now it's, like, gone viral on the internet, and it seems to be more popular than any song Tom Rosenthal himself has written.
That's got to be satisfying as a father.
Or humiliating.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I'm sorry. Every time I say satisfying as a father, I do ultimately mean humiliating.
All I know is I would love for all of the news to be sung by children.
Oh,
isn't it already?
Your joke beats mine.
Some days it feels like it. I love it. I love it. All right. Well, with that wonderful palate cleanser for the week, we're going to jump right into some big, heavy news stuff. Every week, I have my panelists describe their week of news in only three words. Andrew, you're going to go first because you have some thoughts about the story of the week, talking about coronavirus. This thing is here. It was declared a public health emergency this week by the World Health Organization. More and more countries are saying we have cases here. Singapore and Mongolia have sealed their borders with China. This is getting big, but you've noticed something in the coverage of it, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to, hopefully this doesn't disqualify me three words, because I'm going to use an acronym as one of my words.
What is it?
But my three words I thought of was MSG gotcha.
Okay. MSG so, being?
Monosodium glutamate.
Say that 10 times fast.
Monosodium glutamate.
Uh-huh.
And really, I can't stress enough, not a public health expert, but what I am is a Asian American person who has dealt with my entire life this idea that Chinese food specifically, so I'm Chinese American, is gross, it's unhealthy, it's unsanitary. I think that that's the undercurrent sort of every time a pandemic comes up out of Asia.
Well, there are these visuals of, you know, these open-air Chinese food markets, you know, with the American or Brit journalists coming in saying, look at this and look at the food and da-da-da-da. And there are a lot of parallels to, you know, coverage of the SARS virus.
Yeah.
Do you think that the way that we talk about the origin of this virus and those markets and food culture of some Chinese people is wrong?
Yeah, well, so there's nuance. There, of course, there's right ways to talk about it. And you know, there is an argument that those markets are not ideal. But the reporting on this tends to go towards exotifying there's basically like an Orientalist air to it. There was one quote I pulled where they mentioned some sell unusual fare, including live snakes, turtles, and cicadas, guinea pigs, bamboo rats, badgers, hedgehogs, otters, palm civets, and even wolf cubs. Only one or two of those are relevant to this particular virus, particular story. So a lot of
Yet they list the whole thing.
It's sort of just about, you know, making this seem foreign and exotic. I mean, to me, I was like, if you can hear the sort of like Ching Chong music playing in the background when you're reading the article in your mind's eye, that's where it sort of falls down. And, you know, I think the other thing that Americans in particular don't think about is that we do these practices, we just put them behind, you know, where we can't see them in places like factory farms. You know, we have animals crammed up against each other in unsanitary conditions. And I think that it's just that the signifiers of Asianness and foreignness are really coming to bear in this, in the way people talk about the pandemic.
Yeah, but you also, food is such a cultural touch point. I mean, you think about bushmeat in Africa, and there's some outbreaks associated with that. These are this is where their food comes from. So one culture's shark fin pate.
Haggis. All of it. Yeah, I mean, like, everyone has weird food practices. I remember growing up, folks in my family eating chitlins. It's not like Americans are, like, less into strange, and strange is such a loaded word anyway, but strange food.
And also in getting into the reasons that there are bushmeat, wild game markets. I mean, the fact is the rest of the world is not as prosperous and as food secure as places like America. And we are not great.
Yeah.
But like,
People eat what they have to eat to survive.
Yeah.
I want to talk more about MSG.
Oh, yeah,
you mentioned
absolutely.
That in your three words. So MSG speaks to the general history of the way that we treat foods from Asia here in the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, decades ago, Americans were scared of Chinese food because they thought the MSG was going to kill us.
Yeah, or not just kill us, but the idea that Chinese food is dirty has its antecedents in the wave of Chinese immigrants who were very poor from, you know, mostly the Hong Kong, Canton region. And those people were just kind of slinging whatever food they could and then modifying it towards American palates. And one of the things that makes all food good is monosodium glutamate.
Yeah.
It is the taste of good.
It's sexy salt.
Yeah, exactly. And there was an article in the 60s, I believe, that basically started a thing called Chinese restaurant syndrome that was largely debunked and contained just this idea that maybe it's the MSG in Chinese food that is giving this person
like sweats and fever.
Sweats and,
fevers
and aches, which also is just basic overeating and or could be attributed
to anything.
You just
ate too much, dude.
Yeah.
And so this was disproven. And also, Americans have MSG in everything, like Doritos.
Yeah, that was my other option for three words is Doritos got MSG.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, the show where we catch up on the week that was. I'm Sam Sanders here at NPR West with two guests, Julie Cart, reporter for Cal Matters, and Andrew T., host of the podcast Yo, Is This Racist?, also a writer for ABC's Mixed Dish. I think it's our first time that we've had like a TV writer in here, highfalutin Hollywood type.
I'm going to be absolutely frank. There's a tiny chance I'm going to be late for work because of this, and I wanted that plug-in so my bosses won't get mad at me.
Done.
That is 100%
this will stay. This will stay. Julie, you have three words about another story that's been in the news seemingly constantly, at least here in California, for years now, the wildfires.
Wildfires in Australia.
Yes, yes. So there are some parallels between what's going on there and going on here, huh?
Yeah, there are, more than you might think. So my three words, and I'm going to cheat, but
it's
that's who I am.
At least you said you're going to cheat.
That's it.
Now we know.
I feel like if I just say that I can, then I can get away with it. And if that sounds like the
Xenophobia thing. If I just say I'm xenophobic, it's cool, right?
Actually, I was thinking of impeachment, but okay.
Oh.
Okay. It's not an offense if I think it's for the common good.
That's right.
So, okay. My three words are research, science, and self-reliance. And since that's hyphenated, that's that
we'll
counts as one
it.
Idea.
We'll
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote a while ago about the commonalities that California and the American West have with Australia in terms of fire.
Okay.
Landscapes are similar. Trees and plants that are growing are similar. Similar aridity, mm-hmm. you know, experience of drought. And even the topography. So there's a lot going on that brings us together. And
yeah.
in fact, until recent years, the firefighters in the West in our winter uh-huh. would go help Australian firefighters in their summer and
really?
Vice versa. But these are continents that are formed by fire. The American West has plants that need fire to propagate and do all kinds of
yeah.
things. And the same is true for Australia. But they have been studying it rather seriously for quite some time. And a lot of their research has informed policies that are adopted here in
okay.
Europe and also obviously in Australia. So they really rely on research to drive policy. And that is not exactly how we
yeah.
do things here.
Well, we really just
right
now don't have a comprehensive policy for this kind of stuff. I mean, California's trying to make some moves. But the federal government is not passing, you know, laws in D.C. that mandate certain types of, you know, fire mitigation. We're not doing that right now.
No, we don't have a nationwide firefighting force. You have the U.S. Forest Service, and then California has an extremely robust, one of the largest firefighting forces in the world, including the largest aviation. We have more planes and helicopters and bombers and all kinds of things at our disposal. So
yeah.
We've taken up the slack, as most Western states have.
Yeah. What is the biggest difference in the way in the moment that Australia or versus California or the West will deal with the fire in terms of, like, the people on the ground stuck in this stuff?
I think it's the self-reliance part of it. The Australian approach is born from their mythology about themselves. We tamed this continent and how rough and ready they are and self-reliant. And it also comes from the reality that people are strung out on sheep stations hundreds of miles from any kind of water pump or anything, any
yeah.
help, any expected help. And they have to fend for themselves, which Americans do as well in ranches and farms. But it's a bit more widespread there. So their approach is to train people who want to be trained. It's a high level of training. It's excellent.
Train them to stick around and fight at their house.
Stay and defend. The policy is either leave early, get the hell out of here, don't
uh-huh.
get in the way, don't put yourself in jeopardy
uh-huh.
or others, or if you choose not to do that, stay and defend your house, and it can be done. And the science has shown how sheltering in place in a house can actually work
uh-huh.
and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. What are some of the things that Australia does now that California could just, like, try to do tomorrow to help?
One of the things, again, that was born out of science
uh-huh.
They said to themselves, what's causing these fires? And
yeah.
the fires in which people die, what are the cause of those fires?
Yeah.
So since the 50s, 80% of the deaths from fire in Australia have come from utility lines.
Huh.
And we have a similar problem in the States.
Yeah.
As aging transmission lines and distribution lines, you know, just get in the way of wind and things that are very flammable. So Australia undergrounds the lines. So if you are a power company and you're extending power to a new subdivision, you're digging a hole and putting it in the ground.
Huh.
It's hugely, hugely expensive. Estimates here are $2 to $3 million a mile to do that.
Oh, wow.
So there are many things that could be done. They just cost dough, and that's when you stop.
Well, and like the rich here, they'll just work around it. Like, I remember those stories during the last wildfire flare up in California. The rich people have, like, these secret private firefighter companies for hire for themselves. Remember that?
Yeah, firefighters hate that because those companies are
yeah.
in the way. They have huge trucks. They are standing by, you know, with foam and gel to coat these houses. And that's what they're paid to do. But they're also taking up space.
Blocking the roads.
They're blocking the roads, quite literally. And they're people that firefighters and first responders have to look out for.
Yeah. You know, it felt like the Australian wildfires were very much top of mind for a week or two. Then they faded. But I'm seeing this report this week that there was a state of emergency declared in Canberra. It is still burning over there. Australia is still on fire.
26 million acres. I mean, it's kind of astonishing. 2,000 homes, 28 people.
Wow. And it's still going on.
It's still going on.
All right, it's time for a break. Coming up, we're going to talk about Kobe Bryant. His death has raised a tough question. How do you mourn a celebrity when some of their past is controversial? What is on and off limits when making sense of someone's legacy? We pose those questions to a sports journalist who knew Kobe personally for years. That is after the break. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, a truly affordable online counseling service. Fill out a questionnaire online and get matched with a licensed counselor best suited to your mental health needs. Whether it's depression, anxiety, or trauma, BetterHelp will help you overcome what stands in the way of your happiness. Learn more at BetterHelp.com and get 10% off your first month with promo code MINUTE. BetterHelp. Get help anytime, anywhere.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This from NPR. How do you turn an okay idea into a better one? Check out the How I Built This podcast and my live conversation with Stuart Butterfield, founder of Slack and Flickr, as he explains the art of the pivot. Listen now.
We are back. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, the show where we catch up on the week that was. I'm Sam Sanders at NPR West with two great guests, Julie Cart, reporter for Cal Matters, and Andrew T., host of the podcast Yo, Is This Racist?, also a writer for ABC's Mixed-ish. We understand that you might be late for your day job writing for that show today because of us. We apologize. Hope your bosses hear this.
Your phone's been buzzing. I don't know if that's anything.
Where's the script?
I'm almost there.
Traffic.
Yes. I want us to take a second now and talk about what's been the biggest story for L.A. this week, at least my L.A. This is the death of Kobe Bryant. It really hit me hard in a way that I didn't expect. Like, I'm from San Antonio, Texas. Spurs fan. But lifelong Spurs fan. Mm-hmm. I remember booing against Kobe in my youth. And when I heard the news, I was crushed. How did you guys take the story this week?
I was a little surprised, I think, and this is purely my own L.A. ignorance, uh-huh, that how much Kobe meant to everyone.
L.A. loves Kobe.
Yeah, in a way that I had always, I didn't realize, and I was talking to some basketball fans last night, actually, who are not Lakers fans, uh-huh, and who were very emotional about the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was way out of step with a lot of people in L.A. this last week.
Tell me.
Tragedy, I mean, these children, I mean, to have a family wiped out in this thing, and it's just awful. And he leaves behind three other kids and a wife. I mean, that's the tragedy to me. Not that our mighty hero has fallen, because I used to be a sports writer, so I don't have any illusions about how human all of our sports heroes are.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And there were big questions this week about how to talk about the legacy of this very successful yet flawed man. You know, Kobe had an extraordinary career. He went from teen basketball star to Lakers legend. And after his retirement, he actually won an Oscar. And obviously, his death resulted in a massive outpouring of grief, but it also raised some very big questions. What does it mean to look at a celebrity's legacy holistically? When you're mourning someone, are there some parts of their biography that you have to keep out? And who gets to make these decisions? Jemele Hill is a writer at The Atlantic. She has been covering sports for years, and she's known Kobe Bryant personally for a very long time. I put some of those questions to her. Here's our chat. To start, Jemele said covering the Kobe story this week, for her, it's been difficult.
It's kind of odd in a way because as a journalist, as you know, your job is to be objective and just the facts, ma'am or sir. Mm-hmm. And the longer you cover somebody, there is just this comfortable, easy relationship. You build a rapport.
They call you, you call them, y'all talk.
I mean, it happens. And while I did not cover Kobe as long as some people did, mm-hmm, this is somebody who has been woven into the fabric of all of our lives because we've known him since he's a teenager.
Yeah, and people forget he was around for a long time.
A long time. You know, came on the scene at 17, and it's just feels so surreal.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, because he started so young, I remember when he took Brandy to prom.
I remember that, too. I remember his press conference. I remember when he was airballing shots against Utah in the playoffs.
Wow.
You feel like you see somebody at every stage of their career and life.
Yeah. The story of how you two met and ended up becoming something approaching friendship, it involves the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah, he had made some comments about the Trayvon Martin case where he seemed to give defense of George Zimmerman, and he didn't quite understand the gravity of what we all just saw happen. He essentially said that just because he's black, people shouldn't obligate him to speak out on a black issue. And he was, you know, kind of in the camp of, we need to hear all the facts and all this. And I'm just like, well, the fact is somebody went to the store to get snacks and wound up dead. And the other person jumped out their car looking for a conflict.
Yeah. So you call him out.
I did.
And he does a very interesting thing. He like DMs you and says, what you talking about?
He did. Kobe DM'd me and tells me to call him and leaves his number.
How long was the call?
An hour, which is what really surprised me. But Kobe came into that conversation not only wanting to share his perspective, but wanting to learn. Mm. And that's what was really different about that and about him, is that he was a consummate, constant learner.
You know, as soon as we all got the news of Kobe's passing, a big question about how to discuss him and his life surfaced. And that was whether or not we should or could talk about the sexual assault case he dealt with a few years ago. It's still an issue of discussion. When is it right? Can we talk about it? And how? Where do you land with that?
I think it's completely fair to talk about it. Mm. Context is everything. Mm. I realize that a lot of his fans feel like it's tacky to bring that up, but I think they need to understand that this actually happened. We all saw it. I know that for people who have a lot of love for him, that's hard to see. They remember a different Kobe Bryant than you do.
I want to talk more about, you know, figuring out when it is appropriate to talk about those more unsavory details of someone's life. A lot of folks said, don't do it the day Kobe died. Wait a little bit. But I wonder, is there a rubric or a scale of when to know when it's time? And does that rubric depend on the celebrity?
I think it does. And we also have to factor in the circumstances around his death. This was not Kobe Bryant dying in old age. This was somebody who died in a helicopter crash with his 13-year-old daughter. Mm. It's not the same because the circumstances are different. So excuse the poor analogy. Bill Cosby did a lot of great things, all right? The support that he showed HBCUs, how he presented a different image of black life, black family life on television, that's a part of his story.
Yeah.
So should something happen to Bill Cosby, clearly, he's in jail for a reason. He's a monster. Got it.
Yes.
But there will be people that talk about the positive things that he did. And as much as the end of his, you know, sort of time as this public figure is disgraceful, we cannot erase the fact that he did do all these other things.
You wrote a wonderful essay about your relationship with Kobe that published, I think, the night that he died. And you did not include discussion of the rape case.
I had a brief mention, but you're right. I did not belabor and go into details.
What was your mental calculus in figuring out how to, if to, talk about that?
It was a struggle. And quite honestly, I asked a lot of other journalists. Mm. And I tried to speak very clearly from the point of view and context of our relationship. Yeah. I didn't want people to think that I was, you know, taking shots at somebody or anything like that. Mm. But I also wanted to be careful as to not disrespect survivors, disrespect even the young woman who was a part of this incident. You know, let's not forget that that's the other half of this equation.
Exactly.
And I didn't want to minimize it. I didn't want to, as we unfortunately do in sports, we tend to talk about things like sexual assault cases, domestic violence cases as distractions.
Yep. And things that the man has to overcome.
I was like, you know who has to overcome something? The young woman who's on the other half of it, because we don't know her identity or her name. And
she's not rich.
So I was conscious and aware that as I wrote, and it was hard. I mean, this is the toughest column that I've ever had to write. Mm. And not just because the fact that I got to personally interact with this person on several occasions and got to see his passion, his love for life, and the love for his children. That's part of why it was hard to write. The other part of it was the way that he passed, the fact that his daughter was with him, thinking about the other families on that plane. And maybe because Kobe and I are separated by 3 years in terms of age, it's going to hit a little different because this is somebody that is in your peer group.
Yeah.
And from a purely just from my career standpoint, having seen him just evolve from, and I'm just going to, for the moment, put the sexual assault case out of it because some people have made it seem like he evolved from sexual assault. I'm like, no. Taking that part out of it, remembering how cocky he was.
Oh, yeah.
This was somebody, it was funny because when I did two sit downs with him, I did one with him at ESPN. Mm-hmm. And the one question I was not allowed to ask him was about his rap career. That was the one question they did not want me to ask him. And I thought that was hysterical. I was like, so I can ask him about the times him and Shaq almost fought, or I can ask him about like a number, but I can't ask
him. But no rap. What was his single called? Oh, Lord.
I thought it was called K-O-B-E. And that's what I mean about evolution, is that this dude at one point considered being a rapper.
Oh, man.
It was kind of the in vogue thing. There was a lot of...
Everyone was doing it.
And Kobe got in on that trend. So to go from, you know, from that...
To getting an Oscar. He learned something.
Like, you know, maybe I should stay in my lane.
I kind of feel like, you know, in spite of the tragedy of Kobe's death, his life and his death and his legacy this week offer us a chance nationally to have a conversation about how to mourn celebrities holistically. And this could be a teachable moment about how to properly and respectfully consider all sides of complex public figures. Do you think America at this point is taking advantage of this potential teachable moment?
I think we learn about it in pockets. The problem with sports celebrity, which is, I think, a little bit different than entertainment celebrity, is that, you know, you have huge pockets of fans that have been dedicated to this idea that this person can do no wrong. Mm-hmm. People don't want to make moral decisions when they're consuming entertainment. Mm. They just don't. People consider sports to be escapism. You know, you can go to a very serious movie about a really serious issue. People will go to a movie about 9/11. No problem. Mm-hmm. Discuss it afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
People don't do that in sports for the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's escapism. So yeah. I think it just makes these conversations about totality much harder.
And having to question Kobe's legacy in that way almost means having to question how you conceptualize basketball for yourself.
Yeah. And what how it you means. Conceptualize your humanity, because the part that none of us really are comfortable wrestling with is that if I still cheered for this person and I know this was something they could have possibly done, what does that say about me?
Thanks again to Jemele Hill. You can read her writing at The Atlantic, and you can check out her podcast called Jemele Hill is Unbothered. It's on Spotify. All right, time for a break. When we come back, my favorite game, Who Said That? I'm Sam Sanders. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BritBox. Discover powerful new series like Three Little Birds and BAFTA-winning drama Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor CarMax. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because CarMax believes you shouldn't just settle for a car, you should love your car. That's why every car they sell has CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. Don't settle. Find love at first drive. Start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Why is it so hard to make new habits? Are pets really that great for us? Why can't I remember where I put my keys? Would you rather be given an award or a bonus? Answers to these questions and more every week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, the show where we catch up on the week that was. I'm Sam Sanders in studio at NPR West, joined by two guests, Andrew T., host of the podcast Yo, Is This Racist?, also a writer for ABC's Mixed-ish, and Julie Cart, reporter for Cal Matters. Y'all, it is time for the hardest part of this show, my favorite game. Who said that?
Ooh, I'm just saying that.
The smiles just fell off your faces. Case of the nerves. This game is very simple. I share a quote from the week. You got to tell me who said it. The winner gets nothing but bragging rights.
Boom.
All right.
Who Can't studied? Because there was a... I sent you guys a study guide yesterday.
Oh, was I supposed to read that? Shoot.
I've been putting all your emails to spam, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Wow.
Sorry.
Wow.
Sorry.
All right, let's get to it. The first quote... Tell me what animal this quote is talking about. He had already started dancing with the Baby Shark song a little when we got him, so he picked it up even more.
Dog.
No. Cat. Play the audio, then you can guess the animal.
I don't know. Oops. Is it a parrot?
Yes, it's a parrot.
Parrots dance all the time. That's just that's a false
okay,
equivalent.
The Grinch that stole Christmas.
No, I like it. Shoot. I like having a science reporter on.
Well, Andrew's covering his paper, so I can't cheat off it. So this is another thing I object to.
I will say this is how broken my brain is. I didn't recognize it, but then once you started playing the audio, I could see the clip from Twitter that I scrolled by.
Well, there's this clip with this parrot like bopping yeah. and singing to Baby Shark. So, okay, this was Henry the Parrot. His owner is Haley Fowler. That's where the quote comes from. Haley Fowler in Kent, England, said that after they began to play the Baby Shark song, the parrot liked it and would chime in on the do-do-do-do-do and dance with it. I'm telling you, that house sounds like torture. who got that point? Andrew got that
I'll
point.
Take it.
Okay, you got that point.
Such a cheater.
Uh-huh. Next quote, we're just going to play the audio.
I like Mike. I lick Mike.
Man.
It was a political ad released
Bloomberg?
This week. Yes. Oh. It's about Bloomberg.
It was about him.
What kind of thing was saying those statements? You didn't see this?
No.
Another animal. Another animal.
Oh, yes.
Guess an animal.
The dog that he put dog. His yes. hand in its mouth.
See? I said dog first time, just to be fair.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, no, you win this one. Okay. No, that was...
You're trying to make an exciting finish.
You said Bloomberg. I would not have gotten that.
That audio was from a commercial released this week from the Michael Bloomberg for President campaign. It's a commercial of dogs endorsing Mike Bloomberg. It was the strangest thing. Play more of the audio.
Mike Bloomberg is the man to lead us.
He will create more jobs.
Mike's not afraid of the NRA, not one bit.
Trust me, Mike will get it done. Yeah.
Get it done. Yes.
So the backstory to this is so strange. So Mike Bloomberg is running for president, but there was this video of him from earlier this week shaking hands with folks somewhere, and he goes to meet a dog that's in the room as well, and he shakes the dog's snout like it's a hand.
And everyone's that's like some Mr. Bean style moves.
So everyone's like, what is wrong with you, man?
Don't shake snouts.
Don't shake snouts. And so in response to the... hectoring he got over that, he released a video saying that actually dogs like Mike.
Oh man,
he's co-opting the dog culture in this
he country. Is yeah. He is Mike Bloomberg. All right, last quote. Tell me what we're talking about here. Love that look. It's our uniform, has been for a while, and now you can buy it.
I got this one.
Go.
Popeyes.
Yes.
Popeyes streetwear yes. line.
Popeyes released
what?
The light of streetwear this week. Oh, okay.
Where
Julie,
have I been?
Google
Sorry.
It. Julie, I want you to see it and tell me if you would ever wear it. Google.
Well, I can. It's probably not.
It's
if
cute.
They wanted to sell, they didn't want it on my body.
I'm going to say.
Hold on. Let me show y'all the clothing line. It's kind of cute. People think it's based on Beyonce's clothing line.
Yeah. I would say you could pull it off for sure, Julie.
Thanks. Thanks so
that
much.
Look from, that look from Popeyes.com.
Oh, no.
Here, scroll.
Not even.
I can see you in that, Julie.
You could pull it off.
It's
it off.
It's a cute color.
Popeyes.
It
if
looks
you're
like
listening.
Stuff that USC ordered and then sent back because it wasn't the cardinal color that they wanted.
Hats off to Popeye, literal hats off. They keep us talking about them.
sailor cap off to Popeye.
Yes. You wouldn't wear the hat. The hat's cute. I would wear the hat. I would wear the jacket. I would, let's be real, I would wear all these clothes. Andrew, you won.
Boom!
Proud of you. Congratulations. You get nothing. I'm not even going to give you a chicken sandwich.
I get less than nothing.
Less than nothing. Yeah. All right, now it's time to end the show. As we always do, every week we ask our listeners to share with us the best things that have happened to them all week. We encourage folks to brag. They always do. Brent, hit the tape.
Hi, Sam. This is Lana. The best part of my week was that I got to go to the High Amazon and hike to a waterfall called the Gokta Waterfall. It was lush and green, and it was about a four-hour hike, but I had my favorite podcast to keep me company and laughing. Thank you for all you do. Love the show.
Hi, Sam. It's Danielle. I'm 24 weeks pregnant, and the best part of my week was finding out that I passed my glucose test.
The best part of my week is that we have finally closed on our very first apartment.
I got to start officially a new role in my company that I've been wanting to do for a few months, and I'm so excited about it.
I drove to Denver for the stock show, and now I'm home and just had a great hike with my dogs and my friends.
Hey Sam, this is Bella from Washington, D.C. The best part of my week was hosting a Shabbat for 20 people. I cooked and I cleaned, and it was so wonderful to see everyone enjoying themselves and relaxing from a stressful week.
Hi Sam, this is Emily from Anchorage, Alaska. The best part of my week was my brand new nephew, Ezekiel Tuane Tuulau'ulu. Thanks, love the show.
Hey Sam, this is Nick in New York. I've been in the city about 6 months now, and the best part of my week was going on my first date since moving here. He was incredibly sweet, and he gushed about Toni Collette completely unprompted, so of course we will be seeing more of each other. Andrew, if you're listening, please never mention this.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. I love your show.
Have a great weekend.
Bye, Sam.
Bye.
Marry him.
That's such a sweet way
marry
to end
him.
The show. That's incredible.
It's done.
Personal.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Marry that man. Lock it down. Listen to me. It's your soulmate. Thanks to all the folks that we heard there. I enjoy these so much every week. Thanks to Lana, Danielle, Zanti, Reed, Judy, Bella, Emily, and Nick. I gotta say, you guys, best part of my week, I've gotten into this pasta making kick. Ooh. I like to make it. And I made some this week, and it was the best batch I've made yet.
What'd you make? What kind of like sauce and pasta?
I made a vodka cream sauce. Ooh. And the noodles, I kind of just I just cut them by hand. They're kind of like linguine-ish.
That sounds amazing.
I'm just really happy with it. Best parts of y'all's week, go.
I got to work from home a couple days. It was very relaxing.
I bet.
We're adopting a dog.
You Yay. Are. Yes.
Yay.
Send photos of the dog
we shall.
Once you have them. I look forward to that. All right, listeners, we want to hear you sharing the best parts of your week on this show. Record yourself at any point throughout any week and send that voice file to me at samsanders@npr.org, samsanders@npr.org. Thanks to my guest for coming in here talking about all kinds of stuff, Julie Cart, reporter for Cal Matters, and Andrew T., host of the podcast Yo, Is This Racist? And writer for ABC's Mixed-ish. You both did so well. You're first time on the show.
Thanks for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having us.
We're a team forever.
It was your stewardship. Yeah.
Oh,
I now have a job at your place.
Right? We're only, please, we're all coming back together only. That's our contract from now on.
I love it. Come back anytime. So Thank much you. Fun. This week, It's Been a Minute was produced by Brent Bachman, Anjali Sastry, and Danny Hensel. Our fearless editor is Kitty Isley. Our superhero intern is Hafsa Fatima. Our director of programming is Steve Nelson. Our big boss is NPR's senior VP of programming, Anya Grundman. Also, special shout out to Anjali's dad, who has a birthday this week. Suresh Sastry, thank you so much for listening and for gifting the world with Anjali, who we think is great. All right, listeners, thank you so much for listening. Till next time, I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
voices that resonate, stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.